From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for February 28th, the last Sunday in February. This is our weekly recap of the week that was in politics and what to expect in the days ahead. So, yes, it's time. Grab that Sunday paper, that hot cup of coffee, as we've got another busy political weekend to talk about. And, you know, we got a big, big win by Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders in South Carolina, Super Tuesday, just hours away. We'll be talking about that much more. But, Dave, what a beautiful day today. I mean, it is just gorgeous
sunny,
out there.
Sunny, 47 at O'Hare right now, and the forecast that we have says a high near 59, but Mike Hammernick at the WGN Weather Center is also saying maybe 60 in spots.
I just saw him say 61 over on the old Channel 9. But, I mean, the sun is gorgeous out there, a beautiful sunrise. I love the, you know, being able to see outside the windows here.
Wasn't it nice to see some daylight around 6 this morning?
That's what I mean. It gets the day started much better. And, you know, I noted this on the calendar. So, of course, we have the big Illinois primary coming March 15th, just a couple of weeks away. And the Sunday before that, because I'm not working enough, but the Sunday before that, that's daylight savings time.
Ah, yes.
So we lose the hour.
Yeah.
And that's an hour I need. I got to have that hour.
Yeah.
So I will not vouch for myself on that Sunday morning of the 13th.
I may be placing a wake-up call.
You might. Yes. Yes. That, or maybe I'll see if I can get the show started by 8 o'clock instead
there you
of
go.
7. How about
okay,
that?
There you
but,
go. No, the clocks do go up an hour very soon. Leap day tomorrow.
Yeah, I know.
Now we
That's
have a February 29th.
So a happy birthday to everybody.
On the 29th.
The leapers,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Also wanted to mention here, I'm going to be Dave Downer here, not Debbie
what?
Downer, but David Downer about the weather, because getting into Tuesday and Wednesday, cold again, into the 30s, snow, freezing rain perhaps later in the week. So it's not over yet. What that means is get out and enjoy it today.
Where do I get your microphone to cut off? I mean, what?
Bob can do that. Well, I'll volunteer that information.
Yeah, but I didn't know Monday was supposed to be in the 50s because the original.
Yeah, sunny tomorrow, high near 50.
Yeah.
Windy again. But yes, tomorrow will be a decent day as well.
So, which is kind of nice, you know, for a Monday because just there's something about. Like last week, how Monday just kind of went after the weekend. But no, it's a beautiful day out there. You don't need a heavy coat. That's part of the great thing. Lots of joggers going by here out on Michigan Avenue, and it's a great day. And yeah, we've got the Blackhawks game breakfast special today, a brunch game.
Yeah,
11:30 at the United Center against Washington, and. Hawks making some big trades in the last few days that my buddy Chris Cook, the Blackhawks beat writer for the Tribune, he noted, you know, I think Stan Bowman, the GM, really wants another Stanley Cup. And I'll tell you, they've really solidified the team and getting Andrew Ladd back. And I'm looking forward to today because last week was that Stadium Series game that didn't go so well up in Minnesota.
No, so. that was another downer.
Yes, that was very much a downer, very much a downer. And of course, it's Oscars Sunday tonight. And I don't know about you, Dave, but I don't remember the last time that I went to see a movie. It's been a long time since I've been out at a theater because I get enough theater watching the politics that's going on.
I remember the movie.
Yeah,
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
That's the last
no.
I was going to say.
That actually won Best Picture about 40 years ago.
It's
I
hard
did
to
see that in the theater.
Well, that wasn't 40 years ago. But and yes, I have been to the theater since talkies were invented. Okay, I want to make that clear. But, yeah, I really don't know. I'm almost thinking it was back when my daughters were young and I took them to go see.
You're kidding.
No, you know what? Because you see, you're able to, you know,
you
with
can
our technology.
Wait, get it Netflix right. And HBO, and that's true. That's very true. I didn't want to miss a movie like Gravity, though, in IMAX 3D. And
no,
Dean
yeah.
and I were talking about this, and I sure am glad I went to see that because I was dodging space debris in the IMAX.
I would have loved to have
there.
Sat behind you, watching you
wave
duck
my arms.
And dive, and yes, that would have been tremendous, actually, and it would have been great not even watching the movie, just watching you, you know, looking like some battle-worn goaltender
out,
from the NHL.
Look out.
Yeah.
Hey, here it comes.
That's a great visual for this morning, I got to tell you. Oh, wow. But, yeah, so we have the Oscars.
What this means, Rick, is that we need to get out more.
Yeah, right.
Bottom line.
Yeah, you and I both. Absolutely. No secret about that. But and, of course, Dean will be here at 9 o'clock, so he'll have, you know,
this
all of
this is his big day.
Yes, it is. And I really feel sorry. It's kind of like his election day for me.
It is his election day.
You know, it goes on till late at night, and then he's got to turn around, and he's back on WGN television morning news at 5 a.m. tomorrow morning. But he'll have all of the hoopla leading up to the Oscars event tonight. And, of course, kind of interesting, they're bringing more African-American presenters due to the lack of African-American nominees.
That's been a news story,
yeah.
Actually. You know, a point of controversy for the Academy.
Well,
about,
and
the lack of African-American nominees.
And I, if they haven't already, I can guarantee you they're going to be changing the judging rules
mm-hmm.
to try to encompass more diversity. But it'll be interesting to see how that truly is addressed tonight. And, of course, politics and everything. Joe Biden, the Vice President of the United States, will be at the Oscars tonight.
You know who he's going to be introducing?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Lady Gaga.
Lady Gaga.
Yes. And I forget what she's performing tonight.
I don't. It's not the national anthem.
No. But yeah. So all kinds of interesting things going on in the world of politics. And as Dave mentioned, it's leap year, so don't screw up your calendar too much. And of course, we've got Super Tuesday coming up on Tuesday, which is
March 1st.
Which is it's called Super Tuesday. It's also being called the SEC primary because so many of those states are southern states whose universities are in the SEC conference. And talking about roughly a dozen states with a whole lot of delegates going on. And we could pretty much see where the race on both sides may come out by the time that Tuesday is over. And it'll be interesting to see if, on the Republican side, if anybody gets out as a result of what goes on Super Tuesday.
And then we have 2 weeks from Tuesday our own.
Yes, the Illinois primary.
Show here.
And we're going to have a lot more about those races in the shows ahead. Dave's here to keep us up to date on the news. Producer Jasmine is fielding your phone calls. You can reach us at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at that same number, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin, all one word, and on Twitter, @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is trying to figure out the thermostat in the studio with this up-and-down weather that we're having. And as always, you can find all of our shows on WGNradio.com, and you can also get our podcasts at iTunes by searching for me, Rick Pearson. Well, coming up, we've got a great show today. After the 7:30 news, my Tribune colleague Hal Dardick joins the show, and Hal's been covering the Cook County State's Attorney's race as Anita Alvarez seeks a third term, and we'll be talking about that race. Then after the 8 o'clock news update with Dave, Brad Cole, the Executive Director of the Illinois Municipal League, joins the show. The Municipal League, that's the Association of Local Governments in the state. They've unveiled their Springfield agenda, and we'll take a look at that. And then after the 8:30 news, Democratic State Representative Lou Lang of Skokie joins the show. Lou is Deputy Majority Leader in the Democratic Leadership Team in Springfield. And we'll talk about the Springfield impasse, higher education, and the politics of the primary. That's all coming up. But first, we're going to take a break. This is the Sunday Spin. Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. Beautiful Sunday morning, and get out and enjoy the day. It's time for our weekly spin through national politics. And yesterday, Hillary Clinton gained a resounding victory over Bernie Sanders in the South Carolina Democratic primary. Clinton got 73.5% of the vote to Sanders' 26%. Now, a win for Hillary Clinton was expected there, but the size of the win and the support she got from African-American voters exceeded expectations. But last week also marked another big win for the candidacy of Donald Trump in the Nevada caucuses. Now, some Republicans believe a Trump nomination is inevitable, but don't tell that to Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, John Kasich, and Ben Carson. It was there was a debate on Thursday night, raucous debate, name-calling, particularly between Rubio and Trump. Here's some of the highlights from that debate last Thursday night, courtesy of CNN.
We're going to make them pay for that wall. And the wall just got 10 feet taller, believe me.
If he builds the wall the way he built Trump Towers, he'll be using illegal immigrant labor to do it.
You China wouldn't know anything Russia. About it because you're a lousy businessman.
Well, I don't know anything about bankrupting four companies. Right. No, you bankrupted four companies. There are people that borrowed $36,000 to go to Trump University, and they're suing him now.
They actually did a very good job, but I've won most of the lawsuit.
Every justice I nominate will vigorously defend the Bill of Rights for my children and for yours.
Justice Roberts was strongly recommended and pushed by Ted. Justice Roberts gave us Obamacare. Might as well be called Roberts Care.
That on the stage tonight, there are two descendants of immigrants of Cuban origin and an African American. We are the party of diversity, not the Democratic Party.
I won with record-setting numbers. New people are coming into the Republican Party.
You don't know what it
What
means.
Is your plan?
That's the problem.
What is your plan on health care? You
the
don't
biggest
have
problem.
Plan.
I watched him repeat himself 5 times 4 weeks ago. And
I saw
want
you
to
repeat
tell you,
yourself five times 5 seconds ago.
I watched him.
One of Hillary's great vulnerabilities, the corruption at the Clinton Foundation. The next Republican nominee needs to be able to make that case against Hillary. And if Donald tried to do it, Hillary would turn to Donald and say, but gosh, Donald, you gave $100,000 to the Clinton Foundation. I even went to your wedding. Apple should be forced to comply with this court order. Why? Because under the Fourth Amendment, a search and seizure is reasonable if it has judicial authorization and probable cause.
You know what the problem is? Where's the president been? You sit down in a back room and you sit down with the parties and you get this worked out.
Because I would love to do something with regard to negotiating peace, finally, for Israel and for their neighbors. And I can't do that as well as a negotiator. I cannot do that as well if I'm taking big, big sides. With that being said, I am totally pro-Israel. Okay?
The Palestinians are not a real estate deal, Donald.
Okay, no. A deal,
they're not a real
a
estate deal.
A deal is a deal. Let me tell you.
A deal is not a deal when you're dealing with terrorists.
That's our debate mashup, as it were. Quite a show by the Republicans. And in that clip, you heard Donald Trump once again say that Mexico was going to pay for a border wall and that it might get even taller. What prompted that? Well, former Mexican President Vicente Fox told Jorge Ramos of Univision that Fox said he wasn't going to pay for that expletive deleted wall.
I declare, I'm not going to pay for that wall. He should pay for it. He's got the money.
Are you afraid that he's going to be the next president of the United States? What would that mean? What would that mean for Mexico?
No, no, no. Democracy cannot take us to crazy people that doesn't know what's going on in the world today.
That's the former Mexican President Vicente Fox. As I said, Rubio, the Florida Republican senator, was on attack against Trump as we head into this nearly dozen Super Tuesday SEC primary states. And Rubio continued the attack the day after the debate. He started reading some of Trump's attack tweets, and he noted that they had some misspellings.
Lightweight Marco Rubio was working hard last night. This is true. The problem is, he is a chalker. And once a chalker, always a choker. I guess that's what he meant to say. He spelled choker, C-H-O-K-E-R, chalker. He called me Mr. Meltdown. Let me tell you something. Last night in the debate during one of the breaks, two of the breaks, he went backstage. He was having a meltdown. First, he had this little makeup thing applying, like, makeup around his mustache because he had one of those sweat mustaches. Then Then he asked for a full-length mirror. I don't know why, because the podium goes up to here, but he wanted a full-length mirror. Maybe to make sure his pants weren't wet. I don't know. Then...
So that's the nature of our presidential debates today. Trump was able to take some of the focus off of Rubio's newfound attack dog status as one-time presidential rival and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie endorsed Trump, even though this is Christie, who had some pretty harsh words for Trump earlier in the campaign.
He's a good friend. He is a strong and resolute leader. And he is someone who is going to lead the Republican Party to victory in November over Hillary Clinton, which is the single most important thing we can do. So I thank him for his friendship. I thank him for all the kindnesses that we've shared with each other over the years. But more importantly than that, I thank him for leaving the private sector, for seeing that there was a need for strong leadership in this country, and for being willing to step out of the private sector and come and offer himself for public service and for leadership in this country at a time when our party and our nation so desperately needs it. So
this was an endorsement that really meant a lot. Chris is an outstanding man with an outstanding family. He's done a great job. And I think that this is the one endorsement that I felt very strongly about. I wanted to get.
Now, some see Christie's move here as pretty self-serving, a possible position as a presidential running mate. Others have seen it as a sign that the Republican establishment is trying to get more comfortable with the idea of a Trump nomination. Not so for others. Now, you remember how Trump tweeted a warning to the Ricketts family, the owners of the Cubs, about having something to hide? Well, that was about an anti-Trump super PAC, which is funded largely by the family matriarch, Marlene Ricketts. She's put $3 million into this super PAC, and you can tell she's not hiding her distaste for Trump. Here's the latest ad from the Our Principles super PAC.
How much do we really know about Donald Trump? A federal court ruled that Trump's company hired illegal immigrants to help the construction process for Trump Tower. He even paid a $1 million fine. And his new hotel in Washington?
The Washington Post interviewed about 15 laborers at the D.C. hotel site, reporting that many revealed they had entered the U.S. illegally.
Trump makes big money off illegal immigrants. Can conservatives trust Donald Trump? Our Principles PAC is responsible for the content of this advertisement.
That's the Our Principles PAC, which had about a little over $3 million donated to it in January. $3 million coming from Marlene Ricketts, the wife of Joe Ricketts, the Ameritrade billionaire whose family owns the Chicago Cubs. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on The Sunday Spin, my Tribune colleague Hal Dardick, as we talk about the ins and outs of the Cook County Democratic State's Attorney's race.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio. 7:34 on this bright and sunny and warm Sunday morning here. It's just out on the WGN Storm Center patio. A little bit of a breeze out there, but not bad. It's going to be a beautiful day. My friend Marty Plies, he's an engineer, and engineers are kind of interesting people. They're always thinking. And there was news last week about the fact of the city looking to take over, through eminent domain, the old post office. And my friend Marty says, you know, I think this could solve a whole bunch of problems if the city took it over. Five problems, he says. One, the Lucas Museum. Two, the Obama Library. Three, the Children's Museum, because there was that controversy about moving that in the park. And then you've got the casino. And then you could probably build a jail for some of the, you know, offending politicians that take advantage of the previous bunch. So that's my buddy Marty, and there's actually, he points out, too, that there's a massive basement in the south side area of there between Congress and Harrison, and we can house the Gitmo detainees there. So we got all the bases covered here on the Sunday Spin. This is what I have for friends. Thanks, Marty, for sending that along. Maybe you remember on last week's show, I played a clip of an event that Ohio Governor John Kasich held in South Carolina, where a obviously troubled college student from Georgia, he recounted some painful events in his life, but he found Kasich's message as a presidential candidate kind of helped him, and he asked the candidate for a hug. Well, the super PAC that's backing Kasich made an ad about the hug with Tim Allen narrating.
Being president is more than the economy or healthcare.
I was in a really dark place for a long time, but I found hope, and now I've found it in my presidential candidate that I support. And I'd really appreciate one of those hugs you've been talking about.
There is a place for quiet strength, the Oval Office.
New Day for America is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Now, Kasich appeared last week on Megyn Kelly's show on Fox News and was asked about this obviously heart-tugging ad. And guess what? Kasich doesn't like it.
Well, my immediate reaction in hearing about that ad is I don't like it.
Why not?
Look, because I just don't like that. I think it spoke for itself. And look, I'm not going to yell at my people who are, you know, I'm not even connected to go take something off the air, but I'm not comfortable with that. Look, a woman tonight talked about 5 suicides in her family. Earlier today, a lady came and talked to me and hugged me and told me about an autistic child, an adult child, and a 16-year-old that has a mental illness. If I can be able to touch people and have them safe to come and talk about things they care about, that's great. But something strikes me wrong about it. I haven't thought about it, Megan. What can I say?
Now, we talked about Hillary's non-surprise win in South Carolina, and helping to get her that victory was the support of African-American voters. 7 in 10 African-American voters voted for Hillary Clinton. And one key part of the strategy of her part of getting African-American support was Congressman James Clyburn's endorsement of her candidacy over Bernie Sanders, something that she featured in an ad.
I think that if one were to look at the qualifications of the candidates, really reflect upon what our country can be, and look at who can best get us to that place, I think it's hands down Hillary Clinton. Hillary is the only candidate I trust to fight the injustice too many feel and build on the president's progress, not rip it away. My heart has always been with Hillary Clinton.
That was Congressman James Clyburn in South Carolina. Clinton's opponent, Bernie Sanders, was in Chicago last week at a rally at Chicago State University. The Vermont senator decried the costs of higher education, touted his plans for free tuition at public universities and colleges. And the Vermont senator also decried the problems that Chicago State was facing as part of Illinois' budget impasse. Sanders' address to 7,000 people came the day before the school said it was preparing layoff notices. Here's Bernie Sanders.
Why are people being punished for getting a college education? They should be rewarded, not punished. Why is anybody in the world talking about shutting down colleges? What we should be talking about is making public colleges and universities tuition free.
Now, meanwhile, we have Illinois Republican Senator Mark Kirk, who broke ranks with party leadership and said he wanted President Barack Obama to forward a Supreme Court nominee to the Senate to replace the late Justice Antonin Scalia. Kirk also said the Republican-led Senate should hold a vote. Kirk's remarks came a day before Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky delivered an emphatic no.
Presidents have a right to nominate, just as the Senate has its constitutional right to provide or withhold consent. In this case, the Senate will withhold it. The Senate will appropriately revisit the matter after the American people finish making in November the decision they've already started making today.
Now, McConnell's remarks prompted several Democrats, including Illinois Senator Dick Durbin, to take to the Senate floor to denounce the GOP leadership for not fulfilling, in his words, their constitutional duty.
seat on the U.S. Supreme Court lies vacant because of the death of Justice Scalia. The president has the constitutional obligation, as I've read, to name a nominee to fill that vacancy. And Senate Republicans are now saying they won't even hold a hearing on that nominee. If the president sends a name, and he will, to the Senate to fill that vacancy, they have said they will not hold a hearing, they will not schedule a vote, and listen to this, yesterday, Senator McConnell said, I will not even meet with that person. This is a new low.
And finally, in our spin through the week in politics, President Obama submitted his plans to close Guantanamo Bay, the U.S. prison in Cuba. Everybody knew that the president was going to propose this. Everybody knew that kind of plan was coming. Even some talk of the unused state prison in Thompson in northwest Illinois that was sold to the federal government, the Supermax prison. A lot of talk that that actually might be used as a place to house Gitmo prisoners. But Republicans say the bottom line is they don't want terrorists being housed on U.S. soil. Here's the president.
Today, the department is submitting to Congress our plan for finally closing the facility at Guantanamo once and for all. It's a plan that reflects the hard work of my entire national security team. So I especially want to thank Ash and his team at DOD. This plan has my full support. It reflects our best thinking on how to best go after terrorists and deal with those who we may capture.
That was President Obama talking about his plans for closing Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. You have to wonder if that wasn't part of the negotiations that went on with the Cuban government over the concept of kind of normalizing U.S. relations with Cuba after the decades-long embargo. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on a beautiful Sunday morning on Michigan Avenue, 7:45 in the morning. Joining me now on the phone is my Tribune colleague, Hal Dardick, part of the political team at Chicago Tribune. Hal and I have been, mainly Hal, I'll admit that, mainly Hal's been working covering the Democratic primary nomination contest for Cook County State's Attorney between Anita Alvarez, Kim Fox, and Donna Moore, and they had a pretty interesting debate that aired on Channel 7, was taped at Channel 7. It's actually airing the replay later this morning. But, Hal, thanks for joining me this morning.
Oh, it's good to be here, Rick.
Well, you know, this was kind of interesting, and I think our story reflected it on Saturday, the fact that, you know, for months Alvarez has kind of been playing defense over the whole controversy over the police shooting death of Laquan McDonald and the release of the video and questions about why did it take so long to charge the police officer in that case more than a year after that shooting death occurred in October of 2014, playing defense about that. But she was firing on offense on Friday night in that debate.
Oh, yeah, she came out with guns blazing. I think she felt like she had to, especially targeting Kim Fox, who is the opponent that's getting all the endorsements and all the contributions to her campaign.
Because?
And she came out guns blazing, accused her pretty much of being a liar and about her experience as an assistant state's attorney, because initially she said she tried hundreds of cases, and she, in discussions with the Tribune, backed off of that and came down to a number of about 100. It's tough to prove them all up because they were juvenile cases. And so she called her a proven liar. And she also referred to the fact she had to amend her campaign finances to show that her mentor, Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, had done a poll for her before she even formed the committee for $25,000, and that was considered a contribution to the campaign. So Anita came out, you know, attacking her, whereas, you know, up till then, as you say, she had been largely defending herself about the whole Laquan McDonald, the 13 months it took to charge officer Jason Van Dyke in that case.
And, of course, there's no secret that Toni Preckwinkle has made it a major point that she's all in for Kim Fox in this. And there's not a great deal of friendship that exists between Anita Alvarez and Toni Preckwinkle.
Oh, not at all. They've never really gotten along very well. It started out in Toni's first year in office. About 6 years ago with a budget battle where Anita Alvarez didn't get the budget she wanted, and Bennett evolved into a disagreement over how the criminal justice system works and the diversion of lower-level drug offenders so they're not in jail, in different philosophies of how the office should be run. And although Anita, you know, in the post game after the debate the other night, was saying that the Cook County Board President Toni Preckwinkle is power hungry, that all she wants is the power. She already controls the public guardian. She appoints that individual, and now she wants to control the state's attorney. So that's her allegation. Kim Fox in discussions and says, you know, I'm my own person, and I'm happy to have the support of Toni Preckwinkle, and frankly, you know, without Toni Preckwinkle, she wouldn't be quite as much of a threat to Anita Alvarez as she is, because Toni Preckwinkle engineered that Democratic endorsement of her. The money's flown in from SEIU, the CTU. Well, no money yet from CTU, but they did endorse her, and we can expect some money. And those are people that have traditionally supported Toni Preckwinkle. They're all in for Kim Fox.
And, I mean, yeah, Toni Preckwinkle engineered the slating of her because initially the Cook County Democratic Organization made no endorsement in that race. And it was because of Preckwinkle and her urging that they reconvened and decided to slate Kim Fox. But even having said all this, you still have the fact, and we just had that recent Tribune poll that found that Alvarez with virtual widespread name recognition was backed by 34% of voters, Fox 27%, Donna Moore 12%, 26% undecided. And you got a quarter of the electorate, you know, undecided weeks out before an election, and now you're starting to see the real influx of the TV advertising. And that TV advertising was actually Kim Fox's ad was also a subject of the debate as well.
It was, because she used some of the dashboard video cam images from the shooting of Laquan McDonald that did not show the shooting itself, but it showed Laquan McDonald walking down the street moments before he was shot 16 times, as we all know now. And she said that, you know, that was distasteful and that was wrong for Kim Fox to use that. Of course,
she even tried to allege that it could be prejudicial as far as the trial of Jason Van Dyke, the Chicago police officer that was ultimately charged with murder in the case.
And she does make that point, and at the same time, it's hard to imagine that a lot of folks who watch TV haven't already seen those images.
Correct.
Probably repeatedly.
Correct. I mentioned those poll numbers from a couple of weeks ago, and what was surprising to me then, and she still has an edge as of that point, narrow as it may be, despite the fact that more than 7 in 10 Democratic voters that we surveyed in the poll didn't buy her explanation of her handling of the McDonald case. And explains her handling of the case.
She says that in the McDonald case that she had a joint investigation with the federal authorities, with the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI, and that she was waiting to take action in the case, even though she had decided weeks before she did indict or charge Officer Van Dyke. that she was going to charge him with first-degree murder, but she was waiting for the feds to wrap up their portion of the investigation. Of course, she says she released that or charged Van Dyke hours before the release. The court ordered release of the videotape. And in the interest of public safety, and that the federal investigation goes on, because the other issue that's going on here is a lot of people have alleged that the officers that responded to the scene lied about what happened there. We wrote about how at the Tribune about how the reports in that case did not really jibe with what was seen on the video, that they said the officer was threatened and that Laquan McDonald made movements towards him, which didn't was not backed up by the video. And interestingly, during the debate the other night, Anita Alvarez sort of hinted that there could be federal charges coming. She said, you know, that it's a felony to lie to a federal agent. And that there could, and the obstruction of justice charges are being considered, but she wouldn't go any deeper into that. So she's trying to make it clear, I think, that you know, from her perspective, she was working on the case, whereas Kim Fox and her commercials are saying that she did nothing for 13 months. Of course, a lot of people think that it could have been charged sooner, but that's the debate that's raging right now.
Yeah, and what complicates that, I think, is, you know, one is a matter of law, and she, Alvarez does make the point that it is very difficult to try a police officer. It's not just the same as somebody that's accused of murder, just anybody on the street, that there are legal rules about use of deadly force, those kinds of things. And you have to put together a pretty comprehensive case, and that's understood. But you contrast that with the video that we've all seen and just the horrific nature of that video, which in a political sense is easy to argue, why did it take 400 days or 396 days or whatever to issue charges in that? And Kim Fox makes the point, well, and the whole game plan was for Alvarez and the U.S. Attorney's Office to simultaneously have a news conference to announce state and federal charges. I think that was what the ultimate game plan was. But as Kim Fox points out, we still haven't heard what's going on with the federal investigation, which is ongoing.
Right. Yeah, that federal investigation certainly continues. And Anita Alvarez makes a fair point. It is not easy to convict a police officer in a shooting incident. The standards are different, of course. They're armed by the government, and they're allowed to shoot in certain instances, and they're allowed to kill in certain instances. And there's a Supreme Court precedent that says that if that officer felt threatened, they had the right to fire. So it's a completely different standard. It's a tougher case. There's no question of that. And we've actually seen across the country cases where it seemed like an officer might be convicted, but they weren't. That said, that videotape is strong stuff. And, you know, the argument from both Kim Fox, and maybe even more forcefully from Donna Moore, the another challenger in the race, is that, you know, just based on that videotape alone and those officers' reports, you could have multiple charges in the case. I suppose, you know, all this will be borne out by time and what happens in court, which we won't know until after the election.
Well, after the election. That's my Tribune colleague, Hal Dardick. Hal, thank you very much for joining me this morning on the Sunday Spin.
It's my pleasure as always, Rick.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead in the second hour of the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with Brad Cole. Brad is the former mayor of Carbondale, Illinois, who is the executive director of the Illinois Municipal League.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. A beautiful Sunday morning. I was just out on the WGN Storm Center patio without a coat. I was wearing my Blackhawk sweater. It is absolutely gorgeous out. No excuse not to to get out there and enjoy the day today. Temperatures forecast to get up to 60 degrees. And it's probably because of the fact that I don't have a coat on that I'm now into like week three of my cold that I can't seem to get rid of. But no, just a gorgeous day out there. Some details emerging from the results of the South Carolina primary, the Democratic primary that Hillary Clinton won. 370,000 votes cast. Hillary Clinton got 271,000, 73.5%. Bernie Sanders, 26%, roughly 96,000 votes. And just in case you're wondering, former Chicago mayoral candidate Willie Wilson, who is running for president, if you didn't know, he's running for president. He got, now remember, 370,000 votes cast. Willie Wilson got 1,321, or 0.4%, narrowly edging out Martin O'Malley, who dropped out of the race weeks ago. So those are some of the details. And everybody talks about Bernie Sanders and the youth vote, and there's no doubt that is his big base of support. But among African-American voters 65 and over, Hillary Clinton won 96% to 3%. That's some of the results of the exit polls coming out of South Carolina. And, of course, we're moving ahead, Super Tuesday, and that's going to be a very, very big day on both sides, both for the Democrats and Republicans. And that will kind of set the table for our Republican and Democratic primaries here in Illinois 2 weeks later on March 15th. Reminder, too, on Monday, widespread early voting starts. It had already started. You had to go to your local election authority to vote. But if you check on the websites in your counties, you'll see that local early voting will be starting on Monday for the Republican and Democratic primaries. Well, joining me now on the phone is my friend Brad Cole. Brad is the executive director of the Illinois Municipal League, and the Muni League last week announced its kind of legislative package moving cities forward. Brad, thanks for joining me this morning.
Yeah, good morning.
I noted the number one issue that you're looking for out of the legislature is to make it automatic that the money that comes from Springfield for local communities, make it automatic rather than making it subject to appropriation so it doesn't get caught up in any kind of future impasse.
Yeah, that's just entirely a coincidence with the fact that there's no state budget right now. So we learned a lesson this year. Of course, we were very thankful for the General Assembly and the governor approving the release of motor fuel tax, 911 fees, casino and video gaming, and some other funds that are pass-throughs. They approved that in December through some legislation that was passed and signed. But it showed us that there is a disconnect in the release of some of those locally administered funds that are collected by the state and just passed back through non-general revenue funds. So we're going to try to correct that going forward so we don't have to go back and get legislation if, in fact, there's another budget impasse.
And indeed, as you said, they're just pass-throughs. They're nothing. There is no state take or anything there. It's just an appropriation. The state doesn't get anything out of that. They just collect it.
They just collect it, and they collect it because these are, you know, it's easier for the state to collect it, and some of the fees should be collected by the state. But it's non-general revenue, does not affect the state budget. It's just a simple pass-through. But without the appropriation authority, they can't release it back to local governments. We were able to get that done in early December, just a couple months ago, in time for the winter. And, of course, we were concerned about motor fuel taxes being released so that we could fund the keeping the streets, you know, plowed and salted and safe for the winter time. But also the big one is 911 fees to keep the dispatch centers open and be able to respond when somebody calls for help locally.
And truly, this has never been an issue before.
No, it has not been. Of course, there's a lot of things now that have not been an issue in the past that we're seeing with this budget impasse. But these are local funds for local programs that are paid locally and administered locally. So, you know, we're hopeful that this legislation will pass. It was carried in the House by Representative Moylan and in the Senate by Senator Tom Cullerton. last year, passed overwhelmingly, signed immediately. So we're hoping that the same will happen this year, but it will be for a continuing appropriation ongoing so that we don't have to revisit it every year.
Now, the governor recently delivered his budget address, and one thing that wasn't mentioned among several things that weren't specifically mentioned was the issue of the local municipal share of the state income tax, the
right.
Local Government Distributive Fund, LGDF, for you wonks
yes.
out there. And I don't know about you, but I still think there is some concern that if and when any kind of budget agreement is ever reached, that they may be looking to dip into the city's share of the income tax.
Well, we're certainly concerned about that. And last year, the governor's budget address did include a proposed reduction in LGDF. It was never embraced by the members of the General Assembly and legislative leaders. And I think that was in part because they understand the impact that these dollars have locally, but also because local mayors and aldermen and women throughout the state rallied together to let their legislators understand that the municipal share of income tax is 8 cents on the dollar. And with that 8 cents, we're able to fund most of the basic operations of local government. If the state can't fund their operation on 92 cents, it's really their issue, and not to impede the release of the 8 cents for us. And so our share is going a long way to provide for health, safety, welfare of the communities that we represent. And I think the General Assembly understood that. I talked to the governor about that this year. I think he understands it. I think he always did understand it. Of course, he's trying to fill a budget hole, so he has to come up with some recommendations. But everybody involved seems to be complimentary of the fact that those dollars are spent wisely and well spent locally. It was not included in his budget address this year. We are we're thankful for that, but we're also making sure that we keep an eye on it in case there is something that has to come along last minute, and it's certainly a place where they could look.
Well, and last year, too, and it's still, I think, an ongoing concern, is it was kind of the double whammy of wanting to take some of the city's share of the income tax, while at the same time, and it still remains a very high priority, of the governor wanting a property tax freeze.
Yes, and the property tax freeze is something that affects a lot of local taxing entities. The schools obviously have about two-thirds of the tax bill generally in most communities, so that's the biggest piece of it. But municipalities are lumped into that, and our position is that we're opposed to a permanent freeze just because that's often where the funds come from to pay for pension obligations and bonded indebtedness for capital improvements. This year, I think that that is an area that there could be some middle ground found between the governor and the General Assembly, but more likely in a temporary freeze. And our position would be to make sure that local governments are not harmed by that, that some of the ways and places where we spend those dollars would be protected. But a property tax freeze is something we definitely, are under the microscope with all these different revenue sources because of the state's current situation and trying to find every dollar they can.
We're speaking with Brad Cole, the executive director of the Illinois Municipal League. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. .818 on this Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm here in the Allstate Showcase studio on Michigan Avenue. Joining me on the phone is Brad Cole, the executive director of the Illinois Municipal League. And Brad, before the break, we were talking about the issue of a property tax freeze and the governor having that as part of, his agenda, and the concern about municipalities wanting flexibility. I note as part of the Moving Cities Forward agenda that the Municipal League has put forward, there's also an item about expanding the eligibility of communities to become home rule. And I'm wondering if maybe that isn't some kind of an alternative there when it comes to issues like freezing property taxes.
It is, and we think this is a critical way for the state to allow local governments to be able to have some flexibility, especially in these uncertain times. Right now, home rule communities are established either by referendum or if they reach the 25,000 population mark. And so at 25,000, they're automatically a home rule community, and that's under the Illinois Constitution. Our proposal through the Moving Cities Forward is to lower that population threshold to 5,000. And that has to be done in two steps. One, we're asking the General Assembly to pass a joint resolution that will put the question on the ballot in November for the people to decide, because it is a constitutional amendment. And then the second step is obviously to have it pass at the referendum in November. And with the in the 1970 Constitution, when home rule was established and 25,000 was the mark, I think there was probably some discussion about should smaller communities be eligible or not, but that's where it stayed. And currently there are 211 home rule communities, some of them by population, some of them by referendum. By lowering the population threshold to 5,000, this would open up an additional 173 communities to be eligible by the population threshold. And these are still small communities, but larger. This is a threshold that the state has set for other statutory requirements, the 5,000 mark. So we think in that mid-size range to smaller range size community, it gives them the flexibility. It's not about taxing authority or some of the things that are often touted as a reason to vote against home rule. But it's just more flexibility. They can have additional regulations. You can do some things with crime-free housing. There are intergovernmental agreements that can be entered into. So just any number of things. And we think it's a good move, given all of these other factors that are imposing negative impacts against municipalities, to give them one more tool in their belt.
Currently there is the ability for local communities to do it by local referendum. I'm curious why then go the next step and just kind of make it automatic.
Well, it does create an additional expense, and sometimes the local communities aren't sure if they want to go through that, if you know whether or not it would pass. But this is really a broader public policy issue, and understanding that local communities are making a lot of the decisions these days and are carrying out a lot of the public service. You know, why is 25,000 the mark? Why shouldn't it be 5,000? With 1,297 municipalities in Illinois, adding another 173 to the home rule ranks is really not tipping the scale anyway. And so it's just a broader public policy question, and it would allow for, I think, more people to weigh in on the issue than just the specific communities that are being proposed for it if they've done it themselves with the referendum.
Another issue on the Moving Cities Forward agenda from the Municipal League is local control over prevailing wage decisions. And prevailing wage, very much a topic in Springfield as part of what the governor is talking about as far as his agenda regarding unions. And I have to wonder, and this is something I've thought too, basically prevailing wage that municipalities, local governments that are doing public works projects have to pay the prevailing union wage for those projects. And I have always thought that there might be some kind of flexibility here about not on high dollar projects, not like, you know, building a building or something, but some of these smaller kind of projects that, you know, frankly, in some municipalities, it'd probably be hard to find a union shop to do them.
Yeah, and that's the case where in these small projects, and particularly in small communities, if you have, a limited amount of resources to spend on a project, the further you can stretch it, the better for your local improvements. And so we're not proposing to do away with prevailing wage or anything like that. We understand the reason for it. What we're asking for is to establish an exemption up to a specific dollar amount that would allow for the local community to be able to spend those dollars. And maybe there aren't that many options. There are only a few contractors in an area, and they're bidding the work, but they're actually having to raise their price to be able to meet the prevailing wage. And so this would just establish a threshold level where under a dollar amount, the community could have some flexibility. And we're not talking about a high dollar amount either. I think, you know, for us, the maximum would maybe be $200,000, but there's some proposals out there that are even less than that, $20,000, $50,000 for a project. And that allows those small communities, small projects to be able to be stretched a little bit further. And that's what we're looking for, is just some flexibility, not trying to do away with prevailing wage, just trying to make it so that it's easier for communities to get some progress.
Well, and at the same time, too, frankly, to encourage keeping the business in the community rather than having it in some cases as well. Workers' comp reform. And, of course, this, again, another highly debated topic in Springfield, part of the governor's turnaround agenda. What exactly is the municipal league looking for here when it comes to workers' comp changes?
Well, we have a number of things we're looking at and suggesting, and using the AMA guidelines for permanent impairment, based on some of the current numbers that AMA uses. But in particular, there was a 2012 appellate court case that changed the determination, for instance, on an injury to a shoulder, changed it from an injury of an arm to an injury of the man as a whole. Well, what that does is it allows for multiple compensable claims against the man as a whole instead of being capped at 100% of an arm, and that changes the dynamics a little bit. Now, I want to also state very clearly that our goal is not to do away with workers' compensation or to harm or reduce benefits for anybody who was injured on the job. We have a lot of public works employees, public safety personnel who do hard jobs, and sometimes they get injured. We want them to be safe, but we also are trying to monitor and manage the compensable claims that the taxpayer is paying. And so some of the suggestions are to clarify previous policies, and particularly this appellate court case a few years ago, others to use some AMA guidelines and standards from across the country, and just look at, how the best way to determine compensation amounts and calculations.
Does this in any way affect the causation standard, which seems to be a very big sticking point?
No, we're not talking about causation. That is probably the bigger issue, and it's the issue that's out there that is most highly debated. That's not what we're getting into. We're just talking about some of the nuances, I suppose, mm-hmm. and trying to clarify some of the existing case law that's out there through some legislative remedies, just to give a little bit of relief. We're not talking about causation at all.
Brad, you've seen the legislative process over the years. Don't you think workers' comp is truly one of those things where you could get kind of a, get business and labor and the interested parties together and sit down in a room and kind of come up with an agreed bill?
I think so. And I think in the past there have been some very positive cooperative discussions and some results that have come on workers' compensation. I think that's been proven on the labor and management side. And I think this is a time where this could be a compromise issue where people could come together. And that's why we were proposing, not significant, not massive, not really life-changing proposals. We're suggesting things that are common middle ground where we think we could come together and provide a compromise package on a big issue to see some success, really, that both sides could feel good about, and then the people of Illinois could benefit from.
Brad, good luck with the Springfield agenda. Hopefully something can get done in Springfield.
we're hopeful.
Maybe you'll get a package before the budget gets done. Actually, I would bet odds that the chances are good you could probably get what you want out of Springfield before a budget gets done.
We'll take it.
That's Brad Cole, Executive Director of the Illinois Municipal League. Thanks, Brad, for joining me this morning.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin is State Representative Lou Lang of Skokie, a member of the Democratic leadership team, and also a delegate on the March 15th ballot, a delegate candidate for Hillary Clinton.
Now the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin on this beautiful Sunday morning in downtown Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio on Michigan Avenue. Gorgeous, the sunshine out there. Lots of people actually already out on the street this early on a Sunday morning on Michigan Avenue. So get out and enjoy the day. And Dave, I hope those showers are, I hope that's a small chance of showers.
Yeah, it says just a chance of showers. In fact, slight chance is what it says. Slight chance.
Even better, because I did not, of course, bring an umbrella or a hood or anything else. And I just don't want to get caught. That's all.
No, I says a slight chance of showers this afternoon. And, you know, it could be spotty. They could be local. You know, some places could get some rain. Others might not. So you never know.
There you go. There you go. But, yes, get out and enjoy the day while you can. It's gorgeous out there. With Super Tuesday ahead, John Kasich is telling Jake Tapper on CNN that he'd support Trump if Donald Trump becomes the nominee. And was asked about what do you think is going to happen on Super Tuesday, and Ohio Governor Kasich responded, I think Trump's probably going to win probably all of them. That's about a dozen states coming up. And Kasich says he has his campaign plan, and that's about getting to the Midwest states. Of course, Ohio has its primary on March 15th, the same as Illinois. Florida has its primary on March 15th, the same as Illinois. So you've got to look at Rubio, the Florida senator, Kasich, the Ohio governor. Regardless of what happens, frankly, the biggest test will be for Texas Senator Ted Cruz, because if Trump wins Texas, which is on Super Tuesday, on this coming Tuesday, that would be a very huge defeat for the freshman senator. And be curious to see how he sees his political future in this race after that. Well, joining me now on the phone is State Representative Lou Lang of Skokie, a top deputy of the in the Democratic leadership team. Lou, thanks for joining me this morning.
Happy to. Good morning, Rick.
I know you're a Hillary Clinton delegate, but I do want to kind of bring up how Bernie Sanders last week went over to Chicago State University, which didn't seem to be any accident. Obviously, he's doing very well among young voters, but also the fact of the problems that these public institutions of higher education are having without having any budget.
It was an interesting 2 days. Bernie Sanders spoke there one day, and the next day hundreds of layoff notices went to staff at Chicago State, an unfortunate and terrible outcome over there.
What, if anything, can be done? I mean, you have the governor has legislation, but that, you know, I'll fund colleges and those monetary award program, the MAP grants that everybody talks about. But at the same time, you know, he wants these sweeping, unprecedented budget powers to move money around.
I referred to them as king-like powers.
Don't be shy, Lou.
He threw a bill on our desk and said, if you're not going to do everything I want you to do, then at least do this. And at least meant giving him strongest powers we've ever seen to move money around, to cut line items, to cut rates to providers, all without General Assembly oversight. And I think sometimes he forgets that the Constitution talks about co-equal branches of government, where the legislature is the governor's partner in government, not his employee.
Well, but do you think that, number one, that legislation is real in the same way that in his budget address, where he said, you know, here's my proposal, such as it is, or I'll do the cuts. And I saw it as he doesn't want to do the cuts, and I don't know that he necessarily wants this transferable authority.
The truth is, he already had that opportunity. We passed the budget last May, and instead of vetoing the entire budget except for the education portion, he could have used his line item veto, the power he has under the Constitution now, and made any cuts or changes he wanted to make in that budget. He chose not to do that. He chose to throw us into chaos for his own purposes, whatever they might be.
Well, and I thought in the way that he unveiled this recent budget proposal, which is, it was short on its face by anywhere from $3.5 to $6 million, that in some respects, he kind of undercut his own argument for having done that veto of last year's budget, which you guys sent to him, that was out of whack by $4 million.
Well, he certainly did. Last year, he proposed a budget that was $3 or $4 billion out of balance. We passed a budget that was admittedly out of balance, but said, Governor, this is a budget that reflects the needs and values of the people of Illinois. These are cuts over last year's budget, but we either need to cut more or find more revenue. And now this year, the governor proposes his budget with a huge imbalance and then blames us for the imbalance. There's something amiss there. And so people need to hold the governor account for talking in one day about the excesses of the General Assembly and then doing exactly the same thing himself.
I want to go back to where we began here about talking about Chicago State. I mean, you're starting to see these serious consequences at these public universities. And I'm not suggesting that there isn't room for cutting some of the bureaucracy in higher education, but you start looking at Chicago State sending layoff notices. You're looking at Eastern Illinois, which is laying off people, furloughing employees. You look at Western Illinois University, which is struggling under similar circumstances. SIU announcing, I think, $40 million in system-wide cuts. I think it's a scary time, particularly, I mean, I've got a daughter who's graduating this year, but if I were a kid in high school looking at colleges and universities, I'm not sure I'd be looking at anywhere in Illinois.
I think it's a dangerous road to go down. As it is, in-state tuition at our Illinois universities is at or near the same level of out-of-state tuition at places like Iowa. There's something wrong with what we're doing, and it doesn't help when the governor of the state of Illinois threatens to shut down our state universities, our public universities. It sends a bad message to the business community, the same business community that he wants to bring into Illinois. It sends a bad message to people. And aside from what he's doing directly to the universities, the failure to sign the bill for MAP grants, which are the scholarships for lower-income college students, was just really appalling. We want to lift people out of poverty, and so we say to them, well, we're not going to lift you out of poverty this year. And what about the second-semester seniors who are not able to go back to school, who will not graduate this year or will certainly not get their diplomas because they won't have paid their tuition in full? It is just a heartless approach to running the government of the state of Illinois.
Well, and it's not like higher ed hasn't taken its whacks over the years. I mean, I'm under Blagojevich. I remember when he presented his first budget and he came to the Tribune editorial board. And I don't know if I thought the old formula used to be of new money coming into the state. It was always like two-thirds to grade and high schools and one-third to higher ed. And that was nowhere to be found with Blagojevich. And I said, you know, what happened to the old standby formula? He didn't know what I was talking about.
We have owed higher education, our state universities, money from Springfield that was promised to them for many years through Republican and Democratic governors. That isn't the issue. The issue is, what are we going to do about it now? Governor Rauner was elected on the theory that he was going to turn Illinois around. This is not a good turnaround for Illinois. This is not good for our people, not good for the individuals trying to go to the universities, not good for thousands of people who have jobs at our state universities, and puts a cast over the state of Illinois, which is not a good one at a time that we're trying to improve our economics.
We're speaking with Lou Lang, Democratic State Representative from Skokie and a member of the Democratic leadership team in the Illinois House. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio on Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue. Joining me on the phone is Democratic State Representative Lou Lang of Skokie. Representative, we were talking about higher education, and we got a text from a caller actually touching on Bernie Sanders' visit to Chicago State. And, of course, part of Sanders', I guess, themes, and I think a good reason why he's attracting some of the younger voters, is that he talked about his belief that public university and college tuition should be free, offset by taxing Wall Street in some way. And the caller wanted to know is if anything like that is even possible, given the mess we're in right now.
I think first we need to stabilize our economics, not only in the state of Illinois, but nationally. We can't go off spending that kind of money until we absolutely know what we're going to do. Certainly free college, and many have talked about free or reduced community college. Doing that would be helpful to our society. It would be helpful to everyone in the society. By the same token, though, do we really want to give free college education to those that come from well-to-do families? And so I think rather than, in the short term at least, looking at free college, we ought to be looking at ways to reduce college costs, lower interest rates on loans, more scholarship money. We have to find another way to do this. I don't think we can jump right from where we are today directly into free college education.
Obviously, as we talk about higher ed and the issue of the Springfield budget impasse, and you know, a number of people have asked me, why is it that Speaker Madigan just doesn't sit down with Rauner, lock the door, and let's come up with something?
Well, that is a question that comes from someone that doesn't understand exactly what's happening. So when they have gone into a room, the governor's first question is, when are we going to do my turnaround agenda? He will not discuss the budget until he gets his turnaround agenda. The turnaround agenda is a non-starter by most people in Springfield. And even if it was to hold the state of Illinois hostage, kids with epilepsy or people with mental illness, et cetera, to hold them hostage over the governor's political agenda is just wrong. And so many people in the general public think this is some big war, some big impasse on the budget. But the fact is there is no discussion on the budget. House Democrats, Senate Democrats are prepared to sit down and negotiate a budget. But until the governor of the state of Illinois is prepared to negotiate the budget, there isn't going to be one.
Now, he said in his budget message that he doesn't need everything that's on his turnaround agenda. He doesn't need it everything all at once. But he also didn't really elaborate, you know, what does he want now? What is he looking at later?
Well, so he's the one that elevated his turnaround agenda to the same place that doing a budget would be. Most people, even members of the Republican side of the aisle, don't agree that that's the case. And so he throws that into his budget address so that some people will think he's being reasonable. He's not being reasonable. We will do a budget within 1 week of the time the governor says, let's do a budget. It's really up to him. He's the roadblock. There's a piece in the Sun-Times today discussing that exact point.
So is it just a matter that even though the governor may call a meeting, that the speaker says, what's the point?
Well, I think the speaker has skipped a meeting or two on the theory that if we're only going to discuss the same turnaround agenda, it's hurtful to the people of the state of Illinois. We want to discuss a budget. And so you don't really have a budget impasse unless you're actually talking about the budget. If you can't agree on a line item, you can't agree on a cut, you can't agree on new revenue, that's a budget impasse. But they're not in the room talking about those things because the governor refuses to do that. I know it doesn't sound right to the listeners. I know the listeners are saying, oh, that Lang's being partisan. But the fact is that he will not sit down and discuss the budget. The budget is just numbers. Yes, they're difficult numbers. But when the governor's prepared to sit down and do a budget, we will have one.
I had Brad Cole from the Municipal League on earlier, and the Muni League has got its legislative agenda. And a couple of things that they have in their list is ones that somewhat go to some of the subjects that are on the governor's turnaround agenda. One is changes in workers' comp, although Brad Cole says we're not looking at the huge issue of causation and that kind of thing, but just stuff that he says kind of goes around the edges a little bit, just in employer costs. And I said, well, isn't that the kind of thing that we can't do like we used to do with an agreed bill that labor and management and the interested parties all sit down and kind of come up with something?
The fact is we have put workers' comp changes on the board. The Republicans won't vote for them. They want more than what we've proposed. Let's remember on workers' comp that just a couple of years ago, we passed a fairly comprehensive workers' comp reform bill. It should have reduced premiums by 20% or more. It did reduce premiums, but not that much. So I never hear from the governor that maybe we ought to take a good look and do a good audit of the insurance companies to find out why they're not passing the savings that were anticipated from that legislation onto the employers of Illinois. They should be doing that. And if the governor is serious about workers' comp reform, we need to take a look at insurance reform as well.
Another thing that's on the municipal league's list is prevailing wage and giving communities some flexibility of lower cost kind of work, I think primarily for smaller communities where they don't have to pay prevailing wage. Is that something that there's any flexibility involved here with the legislature?
I would say that saying we're not going to have prevailing wage is a non-starter, but that doesn't mean we can't talk about regional prevailing wage. So the prevailing wage in Chicago is different than the prevailing wage in Carbondale. The prevailing wage in Rockford is different than the prevailing wage in Caro. So if we could talk about keeping prevailing wage, but talk about regionalizing it, it might help, and I think Democrats would be willing to at least talk about that. But when the governor starts every conversation with, we have to do away with prevailing wage, it doesn't go too far. It's not a reasonable place to start the conversation.
That's Lou Lang, Democratic State Representative from Skokie, a top deputy of the House Democratic Leadership. Lou, thanks for joining me this morning.
Always happy to do it, Rick. Have a great day.
You too. We'll be back with more right after this. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, Hal Dardick from the Tribune, Brad Cole from the Municipal League, and Lou Lang, Democratic State Representative from Skokie. Most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening on this beautiful Sunday morning. And now it's time to turn things over to the great Dean Richards, who probably will go the next 48 hours without sleep.
That's correct. It's the big day. It's Oscar Sunday.
Woohoo!
You can relate to this, can't you?
Well, that's why I said it's kind of like my election day.
Yeah.
It just keeps going. And
that's why I can project Donald Trump will win Best Supporting Actress tonight for some reason.
I wouldn't be surprised to see him on the red carpet, you know?
Stranger things have happened on the red carpet. Not much stranger, but stranger.
The carpet might match his hair, you know?
I don't even think that red carpet. When we say red carpet, we're not sure which one we're talking about.